From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, why Affordable Care Act enrollment among young adults is lower than expected.
Younger Americans tend to be very tech savvy, and they don't suffer tech fools lightly. And the fact that that website was not ready to go, I think we lost a lot of those folks, and we need to get them back.
And can the ACA improve access to mental health care?
Our challenge is going to be linking people in need with providers and making sure people get the right service at the right time.
Plus, being green at the North American International Auto Show.
Fuel economy is a really important story, and you see it in every segment.
And what to expect from Governor Snyder's State of the State speech tomorrow night.
Education and what they want to do with the surplus money will be huge.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us today. We learned this week that young people account for fewer than 25% of the Americans who've enrolled in the healthcare exchanges. Yet participation by young people is considered crucial for the success of Obamacare. We'll find out what it will take to get young Americans to sign up. Then, can the Affordable Care Act improve access to mental health care? We'll talk about what the ACA means for treating mental illness. That's later in the hour. But first, Governor Snyder delivers his fourth State of the State address tomorrow night. Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta, co-hosts of Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics, join me now. Rick, what are you hearing about what we might hear from the governor tomorrow evening?
Well, it's going to be a speech that's going to be really light on legislative priorities, that is, proposed new laws. And that's basically just a nod to the reality that this is an election year, that there's an abbreviated window to get things done. So we'll hear very little, you know, by way of new legislation. And the initiatives that are rolled out will be, by and large, although not exclusively, things that the governor can do within the administration.
There is a list, though. I mean, some ideas, some topics, some issues that he's likely to hit. Education, I'm sure, is going to be big. This is both early education, K through 12, and higher ed.
Higher education, that the governor would like to see, you know, some funding to universities restored that were cut in his first year. That I think in K-12 we might hear some focus on teacher performance. You know, things going in that regard. We should point out, I mean, no doubt that the governor will try to keep the pressure on transportation funding, road funding,
right.
that is something that he will call on the legislature to do.
It was a big part of last year.
It was a huge part of last year. And in fact, the year before, go back to 2011, and the governor was talking about transportation funding. He has said in the past that he wants an additional $1.2 billion a year for roads and infrastructure. He has not gotten that, but it is likely he will continue to push. The question will be, will he try to push for it in a different set of proposals? He's pushed for an increase in the gas tax. So now it's sort of like, okay, you've had 2 years of pushing for sort of the same way to increase revenue. Are
now
you going to look for a new option?
I'll predict that he will not.
Okay.
That he will just tell the legislature, find a way to get this done.
We need to do this. You figure out how.
But at a certain point, okay, so you do that every year. What changes? I mean, you know, okay, you say, I want to get it done. Well, how are you going to make that happen?
Well, we're already hearing dire predictions that transportation funding is not something that can be dealt with in a substantial way before the November election, which means that there are people who are already relegating this to lame duck or later.
All right. Now, we have to talk immigration because certainly his.
That is one of the proposals that we are likely to hear, that this address is not going to be delivered oblivious of the fact that the governor is going to seek reelection this year. And so we're going to see a look back over the past 3 years and what's happened in the economy. I imagine that in particular he'll want to trumpet the hiring numbers, because that's probably the best story he has to tell on the economic front. And then he can also use that to pivot to talent development, which is a huge part of what his economic policy has been over the past 3 years. And a big part of that talent development will be some kind of initiative regarding immigration. And two things to know about that is, one is Governor Snyder is one of, if not the most pro-immigration governors in the country.
He will call himself the most pro-immigration governor.
But you hear that even from today's papers were full of the story of that, and people who work in immigration say that.
So, but I hear that we may get a specific proposal on immigration. And another thing is that when we talk about Detroit in particular and urban renewal in general, that you just look at the population trends in Michigan, that we're not going to get the sort of workforce and the number of people that we need here to attract really good employers if we don't pick up the pace on getting people in Michigan. And probably the most effective way to do that is to be a state that attracts immigrants. That immigration reform has got to be a part of the governor's strategy for helping Detroit.
But how much power does he really have? Because isn't this really in Washington's hands?
Well, and that's a really interesting question.
That's why this is so intriguing.
Right. And why he continues to push for it. But you're exactly right. It's sort of how much can you do as a state?
And the governor was a key developer of a program in Ann Arbor that was sort of the welcome wagon for immigrants, that you connected immigrants who came here with people who were from their own countries, their own regions, and tried to do things
make
to
make it welcoming.
Yeah, to make it a welcoming environment. So he does have a history of actually doing things. And then the last thing is, I don't think we'll hear specific proposals, but next week, Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly is supposed to roll out a mental health report, a set of mental health recommendations, which is something that the governor has talked about since he was campaigning for governor.
Okay.
And so what I believe that he will use the State of the State address to just tee up the fact that that report is coming. And then we'll hear more about that when the governor's budget proposal is unveiled in early February.
Right.
Energy, I think, is going to be something he's going to talk about.
It is indeed. He gave an address on energy last month. He outlined his energy recommendations. We'll likely hear more about that. He's also set to deliver an address on seniors later in the year. So lots to look forward to.
So you found some figures that talk about his batting average, if you will.
Oh, yeah. Well, I love this. We have to give a shout out to the Detroit Free Press reporters, Kathy Gray and Paul Egan. They did some analysis.
That's what we mean when we say found.
we found that some other reporters did amazing work. And so they did some analysis, and they found that Governor Snyder has completed or made progress on 76% of the pledges that he's made in his State of the State addresses in 2011, 2012, 2013. So 3/4 of his agenda that he's proposed is either being worked on or completed. Not a bad batting average.
When you think of previous governors and how people have done with their state of the state and their batting average, is he swinging?
Well, one could argue, though, that the whole time he's been in office, he's had a friendly legislature. I'm saying that and with quote hands, you know, that he's had
his team.
Republican leaders.
He's had a frequently friendly legislature, except when it was a not friendly, kind of hostile legislature.
Zoe, what are you expecting to hear from the Democrats after the race?
Right. We will hear from the Democratic minority leader in the House, Tim Grimmel. He will give the Democratic response, likely to hear a lot about education, that Democrats, particularly in this election year, want to focus like a laser beam on cuts in previous years to education, that Republicans, that Governor Snyder has signed off on. They are going to be talking about that. And, of course, as we talked earlier, that there is this millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of surplus, and look to see, you know, where they want to put that money. And of course, just the likely, you know, we don't like what he's saying. We don't like this proposal. We don't like this proposal. Mm-hmm. But education and what they want to do with the surplus money will be huge.
Right. And we will. One person who will not be talking a lot about that surplus, though, is Governor Snyder.
Really?
Yes. He will allude to it the same way that he will allude to the economy. He will allude to, improved hiring. But there's some tension here. We did the math earlier today, and if you just took the surplus, the revenue surplus that's projected for this fiscal year,
it's 971.
Well, that's
different.
That's spread out. Ah. What is the surplus this year?
So the general fund and the school aid, it's about $216 million for this fiscal year, and if you divide that by 3.6 million people, how many people are paying
tax? 3.6 million tax filings. That's what Treasury processed last year. It's not the way it would go, but it's sort of a rough number. But it would be 60 $1,000 per tax filer. And Governor Snyder, the CPA, is looking at that and saying, you know, instead of $60 per person, how could that money be used for long-term investment that reaps economic benefits, you know, going far into the future?
Make it work harder.
And this is so how this governor operates. CPA, you know, he doesn't ever look 1 year ahead, 2 years ago. He's looking 10 years, 15, 20 years ahead in Michigan's economic future.
So I'm going to ask each of you, what will you be watching for in this address in particular? Lead us, Rick.
Okay. I will be looking to see what election year goals the governor sets, you know, what he thinks can be done before electoral politics really consumes everything. And then the other thing is, I'm wondering if he is going to use this to address some of the social controversies that are rending the Republican coalition right now. LGBT rights, amending the state's civil rights law to protect LGBT people from discrimination in housing and hiring. We've got a same-sex marriage case that's hanging fire in the federal courts. And, of course, we have Republican National Committeeman Dave Ajima of Michigan, who keeps saying incendiary things about LGBT people and recently
Muslims.
About Muslims.
Yes.
Will we see some sort of nod address that directly or obliquely, but something about, you know, civility and inclusiveness. So those are a couple of things I'll be looking for.
Great list.
How about you?
I think Detroit. I'll be watching to see how much he talks about Detroit's largest city in the U.S. to file bankruptcy, of course. And as we've talked about before, Governor Snyder pretty much owns what happens economically speaking in Detroit. He appointed Kevin Orr, the city's emergency manager. What happens in Detroit will have an effect on his reelection campaign. So we'll see how many times that word Detroit is talked about.
And we are expecting Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan will be present at the speech.
Watching for many, many things. Rick Pluta, Zoe Clark, co-hosts of Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
Oh, you bet.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Media preview days are in full swing now at the North American International Auto Show. Over 5,000 reporters from all over the world have converged on Cobo Center, and that includes Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, how are you?
Good. So let's start with your piece in today's news, looking ahead to the end of this month when Fiat takes total control of Chrysler, and you had CEO Sergio Marchionne saying, the location of the headquarters for the combined companies doesn't matter, and to that you say?
Yeah, it does in this town. I mean, the identity of Detroit has long been tied up with being the home to its automakers and the corporate headquarters and all that goes along with that, whether it's jobs and leadership in an industry or community involvement and civic support of various philanthropic causes. It's a big deal. And Chrysler clearly has been a company that's been jerked around by various owners, starting with the Germans from Stuttgart and then the Cerberus Sharpies from New York. And now they've gotten into this situation with Sergio, which I think is in a lot of ways very positive. His argument really is that the way they manage a modern company today, the senior leadership is moving all over the world, and that's true. I don't think there's any question about it. And what really matters is where the shares of the combined company are going to be listed. And he pretty much indicated this week that it's likely to be New York.
Okay.
But whatever does come out of this decision from the Fiat Chrysler board, really the Fiat board at the end of the month, it is going to look different than certainly General Motors as a headquarters here or Ford as a headquarters here.
Really? Well, we saw Governor Snyder at the auto show yesterday, and it's kind of interesting. It sounds like he's tactfully trying to not annoy Marchionne by being too pushy about wanting to keep the headquarters in Michigan, but clearly wanting it to be in Michigan.
Oh, no question. I had an opportunity to interview him yesterday, and I asked him about it, and he was typically a little vague about it, but was willing to concede that he has had a private conversation with Marchionne about it. And I happen to know that key people in the state economic development organization have been lobbying them for some period of time. So, you know, they are comforted by the fact that if it ends up that you've kind of got a transatlantic kind of headquarters situation, they can deal with that. But I think it'll be a win if, in fact, the shares are listed in New York and the preponderance of the company is really in Auburn Hills.
Let's go over to GM. How do you think new CEO Mary Barra is doing in the auto show spotlight?
a little tentative. I think she's been managed pretty closely. I mean, had a four-minute scrum where, you know, people were knocking each other over, and you know, no one could get in a to her and really get a question in edgewise. Compared to Marchionne, as an example, who does hour-long roundtables. I mean, literally an hour long, and then when the roundtable is over and they're right on the clock, then he gets scrummed in the middle, in the front of the room. So. Now, you know, that's not really a fair comparison because he's been in this spotlight for some period of time, both as the Fiat CEO and now as the Chrysler CEO. And Mary, I think the risk is they don't want to overexpose her or get her too far out over her skis, so to speak, before she really gets into the job. So I don't think you can be too hard on them in terms of the way they've kind of managed her access and her introduction. But clearly, she's been of the CEOs here, and there's always a couple who are stars. She's been the star of the show. I don't think there's any question about it.
And certainly, let's just look at GM. Certainly, what a difference 5 years makes when you think no more government ownership and back from the brink of death and winning both car and truck of the year honors. And, you know, the list goes on, delivering 15 newer refreshed models this year.
Oh, it's remarkable. And, you know, I was thinking about this morning, actually, as I was mapping out another piece. You know, Dan Akerson leaves today, leaves Mary with a very, very different company. You can add to that list, they're going to pay a dividend again.
Yep.
You know, they're not, as you said, not in Government Motors. They've got 30-some billion dollars in cash. This is a very different company that she is taking over and in a very different position. And really positioned to run, I think. The product development, to your point, is really doing well. Their products are getting a lot of critical acclaim.
And that was really because of her. And then what are your thoughts as far as the team of Mary and new product development chief Mark Royce, who took her old spot?
Well, I've tested this thought out on people inside the company, too. I mean, I think this is a best available athlete strategy by the board and Dan Akerson, you know, saying who are our best people and how can we set this team up to kind of achieve what we need to achieve. And I think if you tick through them real quickly, Mary is viewed as somebody who is a team builder and is more of a uniter and gets people working together. And that's very critical in the modern auto industry. Mm. The days of the autocratic star are really, I think, pretty much past in this industry. Mark Royce is very much a car guy's car guy, and I think a lot of people believe that the move that he got to that job, it makes a lot of sense. And Dan Ammann, as president, who will be running overseeing the regions around the world, has a lot of credibility on Wall Street. So I think they wanted to be able to telegraph to the street, you know, steady as she goes, the discipline you've seen financially here, you're going to continue to see coming from General Motors. We don't intend to backslide and get into some of the bad old habits. The final point I would make is that of the three people, two of them have spent their whole careers at General Motors,
yeah.
Mary and Mark. And I think they're some of the few so-called lifers, and some people don't like that term, but who have gone through the fire, come out the other side, but come out on top.
Another story coming out of the auto show is how the automakers are serving up performance like that car of the year Corvette, but mm-hmm. with a very careful eye on those tough new federal fuel economy standards on the way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Ford F-150 story this week is all about the aluminum underneath the skin, and they're saving about 700 pounds, depending on how the vehicle is equipped. Per vehicle, that's a sizable amount of weight saving. So really what you have is first blush, and I've actually seen some media reports that have said, oh, they're talking about horsepower again in Detroit. The people don't get it. Well, no, you don't get it, essentially. What's going on is, yeah, you have a Corvette there, but you also have a Corvette that in seventh gear gets 30 miles a gallon.
Wow.
You have massive improvements in fuel economy coming not just from the EcoBoost engines in a Ford pickup, but also from the naturally aspirated engines that are driving Chevy pickups. Fuel economy is a really important story, and you see it in every segment. The other thing that you see here is a real de-emphasis on electric vehicles. What's happened is they're really not catching on to the marketplace. It was less than 3% of the market this past year. And part of that is because people are seeing that, geez, these internal combustion engines, more diesels, more traditional kinds of powertrains are getting better and better and more efficient and more efficient. So you're seeing much bigger gains and in the engineering and on the technology side. And I think you're going to continue to see that because these federal fuel economy regs are going to get tougher and tougher as we go forward.
And people can have their trucks. You can have your Ram 1500 pickup. You can have your Chevy Colorado and GMC Canyon. So, yep, you can do it and still be green.
That's exactly right.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House, thanks for checking in from the auto show for us.
Thank you.
And from the auto show to the Golden Globes. Okay, fess up. How many of you watched your favorite celebrity walk the red carpet for the Golden Globes last Sunday night? I'll admit I did. And this got us wondering, why do we care so much about celebrities, what they wear, what they eat, how they live? There's an old house in Ann Arbor where playwright Arthur Miller lived as a student at the University of Michigan. And there are some who are intensely interested in preserving that old house. It's right next to U of M's Institute for Social Research. The university's expanding the institute and wants the old house out of the way. And if they can't get someone to buy it, it will probably be demolished. Well, all of this got us thinking about this tendency to care so much about celebrity homes and what's behind our seemingly bottomless fascination with celebs. I'm joined by Daniel Kruger, who's a professor and a researcher at U of M. He's done research into that fascination we have for the famous. Can you tell us just why knowing that Arthur Miller slept and ate and lived in a building makes that structure magical to some people?
Well, it starts to make more sense when you go way back in our evolutionary history and think about the way that our ancestors lived in much smaller social groups. And we had people that were our celebrities at the time, but usually they really were part of our social network. And we wanted to know how they got to be the high status people that they were. So by paying attention to them, we could maybe divulge what their secrets were, how they got to the top. And also, it's good to know what powerful and important people are doing, because that can have consequences for you. So in this modern age, we might not actually meet any of these celebrities in person, but at the same time, we still think of them as being part of our social world.
And they, and certainly in a way that was never available before, with now that, you know, celebrities can tweet some of the most sometimes inane thoughts possible, but they're out there, so they are involved with us. Their Facebook pages and social media lets them be a part of their world, but we don't become a part of theirs.
Right. Well, actually, you can like their Facebook page and see all their photo streams and posts. So it's a new age of communication. But I like what you reference in your magical thinking, because that's another part of this. It's magical thinking, not so much in the kind of magical thinking in the Crucible, where people are accusing others of casting spells.
Right.
But it's this principle of contagion. That's another part of our evolved psychology. And long before we knew about the germ theory of disease or we knew how diseases were transmitted, people had this natural aversion to things that probably were bad for them.
Okay.
You know, things that we think are, you know, gross or icky. There's a good reason behind that, because oftentimes they do possibly spread disease. And this is something that you can see both in the sort of negative side that's remarkable. Do you remember just a little while ago when Pope Francis hugged that disfigured man?
Yes.
And that made international news? Well, why is that the case? Because people are averse to seeing, you know, physical deformities, because there's this inherent sense that I could get that too. You know,
yes.
So
yes.
In the same way, we have contagion for positive things. So, you know, if a baseball has been signed by a baseball player, that instantly raises its value. You know, if there's some kind of connection that someone touched it, you know, someone lived there. If you go around the East Coast, you know, you see all these little inns where George Washington slept here.
Right, right.
And of course, they're going to advertise that, because everyone will think, wow, isn't this wonderful? You know, we're sleeping the same place that George Washington slept in.
And somehow that transmits itself. And I'll say I will absolutely cop to being someone like I have a whole collection of autographed posters from movies and theaters. So my Tom Hanks Saving Private Ryan autographed poster is hanging in my basement, and my Russell Crowe Gladiator. I love that autographed stuff, just like I have my whole life. So that's kind of what I'm getting is, oh, gee, Tom Hanks signed this. Is that it?
Right, yeah. And just that contact, you know, raises its value. You know, there's a story of Picasso was asked if this painting was one of his works. You know, there was a disagreement amongst the experts, and he went up to it and he just signed it and said, well, now it's a Picasso. Mm. not really even answering the question of whether or not he was the actual painter, but he says, now it's a Picasso because I've signed it, and that instantly increased its value and certainty.
Interesting. I'm talking with Daniel Kruger, who's a professor and a researcher at the University of Michigan, and kind of looking into the question of what it is about celebrities that fascinate us so, and triggered by the story that the old house that playwright Arthur Miller lived in while he was a student at U of M has to be bought and moved or it may be demolished, and that really has people going. And it isn't just really, for example, we've had other versions of this story. Madonna's girlhood home in Rochester was for sale, and then Eminem's long boarded up house on Detroit's east side recently caught fire, even as a Tennessee woman who is an avid fan was trying to buy Eminem's old house. It's a little bitty old boarded-up house. She was going to turn it into a museum. It raises the question, where's the line that we draw? I totally understand preserving the Anne Frank house, where Anne Frank and her family hid during the war. I got to wonder about preserving the boarded-up old Eminem house.
Well, I guess that's a question of value because his house probably looks the same as, you know, many other houses in the block, and people might not even know. You know, if you bought the house next door and turned it into the Eminem Museum, most people wouldn't know the difference.
Although the hardcore fans knew he used the house on the album cover.
Oh, okay.
Of the current album
and
his first ones.
That would be a key.
that would be a key. Is there the idea that we were kind of laughing about this? That gee, Eminem's DNA could be on the kitchen cupboards.
That's possible. It's possible that they really did leave a physical trace, that if you're to go through the house really thoroughly, you could find it.
Well, now, finally, do you think that that house on Division should be moved and saved? Is that a valuable thing to save?
It would be wonderful if it could be. I mean, for one, it's a really nice piece of architecture. There really aren't too many houses like that left. And in further generations, people would really appreciate that we did preserve that kind of architecture. It'd be really nice if perhaps it could be moved to North Campus and turned into an Arthur Miller Museum.
Well, let's see what happens. Dan Kruger, a professor at the University of Michigan School of Public Health and the Institute for Social Research. Always a pleasure talking with you.
Wonderful to talk with you, too.
Meantime, in the Wayne County city of Plymouth, the question is not about preserving a celebrity home. It's about preserving the last remnant of a factory that was once a deep part of the community, the Daisy Manufacturing Company. Fans of the film A Christmas Story might recall this.
What would you like for Christmas?
Horrified, I heard myself blurted out.
I want an official Red Ryder carbon action 2-inch air range ball air rifle.
Ooh.
No. Shoot your eye out.
Oh, no, it was the classic mother BB gun block. You'll shoot your eye out.
Yep, that Red Ryder Daisy air rifle that Ralphie pined for would have been made by Daisy. Joining us now is Wendy Harless. She is president of the Plymouth Preservation Network. And Wendy, how far back does Daisy go in the history of your town?
Well, it actually started in 1882 as an all-metal windmill factory. But the windmills were not selling very well. And so Clarence Hamilton came up with the idea that they would give away as a premium an air rifle with every windmill sold. The air rifles became more popular than the windmills. And so they actually changed their name in 1895 to Daisy Manufacturing and just sold air rifles then.
Just how was this factory significant to Plymouth?
Well, it was. It really put us on the world map. You know, before that, we were a farming community, very agricultural, and we went from farms to factories with Daisy. And it actually became so popular that there were multiple air rifle manufacturers in Plymouth. We were known as the air rifle capital of the world.
The Daisy factory was torn down to just one wall to preserve that history. This came after there was development for condos, but the remaining wall came down. What did that factory mean to you and others in the community?
For us, for the people who love historic buildings, that building is a real tangible connection to the past. You know, you can stand in front of it and say, this is a spot. This is the place where all of those titans of industry used to come through the doors. And they're the people that really, like I said, they put Plymouth on the map. That doesn't have to come around again.
And it does feel like we do lose a little more each time one of these old buildings falls to the wrecking ball.
Yeah, a lot of people will say, oh, what's one building? Well, it's one now, and then it's one tomorrow, and then it's another one next year. And we've actually lost a lot of our historic buildings in Plymouth just since the year 2000. We lost the Mayflower Hotel, the Grange, the Daisy Factory, the Marietta Huff Memorial Building. I mean, it just seems like every year something comes down. And you start to lose that sense of place. You know, our historic buildings really connect our community to the past, and, you know, they give all of us that sense of shared history, contributing to our greater sense of community.
Wendy Harless is president of the Plymouth Preservation Network, and even though you were not able to save that wall from the Daisy Factory, I'm sure there's much more ahead as far as trying to preserve these historic buildings.
Oh, yes, we've moved on to our next project.
What is that?
Saving Central, which was the old high school.
All right. There's always something. Wendy, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's been a little over 2 weeks now since the Affordable Care Act officially kicked in. We wondered how many people have been able to enroll, how many are getting financial assistance to help pay for the plan, and what deadlines do we need to be aware of? Joining us once more is Don Hazard, who's director of Michigan Consumers for Healthcare. It's one of four navigator agencies for the ACA. Now, the Department of Health and Human Services just reported 75,511 Michiganders have signed up for coverage since enrollment began October 1st. Now, we all know the website troubles really hurt enrollment figures at the beginning. Where do things stand now?
Well, the exciting thing about the enrollment figures that were just released a couple of days ago is Michigan is at 100% of its projected enrollment rate. And that is particularly exciting when you think about the fact that the enrollment tool, which was healthcare.gov, wasn't working for two-thirds of the period of time. So essentially in about a month's time, we made up all that lost ground. And right now, Michigan is essentially at 100% of where we were projected to be. We're supposed to be a little north of 75,000 applications submitted. We're a little bit north of 75,000 applications. So the focus going forward is let's see if we can bump that up a little bit and help the national numbers as well as get more of our citizens enrolled.
Now, I have to wonder, when I was looking on healthcare.gov's health insurance blog, there were still a lot of comments on the comment thread from people who are venting about having problems with the website. This was the national healthcare.gov blog. So knowing that you and your team are working with consumers with the website every day, how fixed is healthcare.gov?
Oh, substantially fixed. In fact, if you look at a chart of the enrollment, it essentially takes off like a rocket about a month ago. When they did the reboot of the website, enrollment just absolutely takes off. So no question, there's pent-up demand, and now that the enrollment tool is working, we can meet that demand. Now, those individuals that had created accounts prior to the reboot, they continue to experience problems. Healthcare.gov has created a delete button to finally delete their old accounts so they can reset their accounts and get past those problems. So right now, error rates are less than 1% at healthcare.gov. So that's very good. That's very competitive with a private website as far as error rates. I would suggest for those individuals that are still having those problems, contact a navigator at enrollmichigan.com. Navigator will be happy to assist them at no charge.
Now, curious, the Obama administration released the kind of demographic information about ACA enrollment that we really didn't have up until now. And they're saying essentially most of the people signing up tend to be older and potentially not as healthy. So nationally, only 24% of those signing up are aged 18 to 34. And we've heard all along getting those healthy younger folks into the tent is so crucial to making this work. Can you tell us any idea how we're doing in Michigan in terms of getting younger people on board?
Sure. So as I indicated, we are at 100% of our target rate as far as applications submitted and approved. Where we need to make up some ground is with younger individuals. So only about 25% of those putting in applications are younger adults under the age of 35.
So we're kind of tracking with the national.
Sure. Yep. We're tracking them too. Mm-hmm. And the problem there, of course, is younger Americans tend to be very tech savvy and they don't suffer tech fools lightly. And the fact that that website was not ready to go, I think we lost a lot of those folks, and we need to get them back. And I think as word starts to get out that those issues were resolved, the website is working, we'll start to get those younger adults back. And especially as we approach the April 1 deadline, and there's more and more media coverage of the fact that we're approaching a hard deadline and that the website is working, We'll get those young adults back.
Is there any plan that you're aware of for outreach to these young folks and direct?
We are, developing internal plans to get on college campuses and reach out to those individuals. It's going to be twofold. It's going to be addressing the concerns about the technical issues at healthcare.gov and make sure they understand those have been resolved, but also reinforcing the many benefits for young adults, like free contraceptive care for all of these programs. Underscoring those benefits that over interest to that age group. That combination, I think, is what's going to recapture that group.
I'm speaking with Don Hazard, who's director of Michigan Consumers for Healthcare. It's one of four navigator agencies for the Affordable Care Act, as we kind of get a temperature check and see how Michigan is doing in terms of getting folks signed up, and we find out we're basically at 100% of what the goal was. So that is good, but need more young people, because there is, I know, concern that if we don't see more young people involved, the insurers could raise premiums for 2015. So you're working on that. Curious as far as some questions that have come up with dental coverage. What's the situation? Because in reading headlines, it kind of seems that it seems dental benefits are offered in some states but not in others. What's the situation in Michigan?
So the Affordable Care Act requires all health care plans to provide dental and vision coverage to children. So anyone under 18 is going to have dental and vision as a standard part of their coverage. Now, the law also allows states to determine on their own basis whether they would like to include adult dental as part of that standard coverage. Michigan decided not to. Now, we will go through that process. It's called the Essential Health Benefit process. We're going to go through that again in about a year. Hopefully, we'll have that conversation again, whether we should include adult dental in part of the basic coverage. But here in Michigan, we made the decision, state officials made the decision, that we're not going to have adult dental as part of our basic coverage. Now, the exception to all that, of course, would be those folks on the new Healthy Michigan program. Adult dental will be part of the new Healthy Michigan program, which starts April 1st for everyone under 138% of the federal poverty limit.
All right, so that takes care of that one. As far as getting financial assistance to help pay for their plan, I saw some figure that said about 85% of the 75,000 Michiganders who signed up got some financial assistance. Can you give us some idea how hard that was for people to piece together the financial assistance that they're entitled to with their application? Is that what you do as navigators?
Well, yeah, we help them figure that out. Mm-hmm. And there's really two types of assistance that's available to everyone. There are tax credits to reduce their monthly premium. So when they select a plan, these tax credits can be either applied monthly to reduce their monthly premium, or they can get it as a lump sum at the end of the year if they would prefer it that way. But there's an additional level of support, which is also there's assistance in your out-of-pocket payments. So, for example, if you would normally have a $15 copay to see a doctor, you may only have a $5 copay, for example. So you need to go to healthcare.gov and have a determination done to determine what levels of assistance are available to you.
And again, navigators like your agency can help people with that as well.
Be happy to help people. And of course, because of the technical issues that frustrated a lot of folks, and they gave up very early in the process. So hopefully now that it's working, some of those folks who we lost will come back and investigate. And one important improvement on the website is you don't have to create an account anymore to shop.
You can browse.
You can browse. You don't have to create an account. So just go to healthcare.gov. Shop around, look at the different plans. Just remember, the prices they're quoting you are without the tax credits. So that's just the sticker price. You have to actually apply to find out what the tax credits are available to reduce that monthly premium.
And remind us now, what's the next deadline coming up? What do we need to know?
Well, every month, you're going to have to be signed up by the 15th if you'd like your plan to start the following month. Okay. But the real hard deadline is April 1st. So as of April 1st, you no longer can go to healthcare.gov and access these tax credits to purchase private insurance, with the exception of if you have a life-changing event. So if you have a child, if you get laid off from your job, that sort of thing, then you can go at any point to healthcare.gov and access these tax credits and purchase insurance. But for everybody else, you have until April 1st. You have to have made your choice by April 1st and to access those tax credits. And again, if you haven't done that, you also potentially are susceptible to a fine up to 1% of your income.
Don Hazard, always good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As the Affordable Care Act rolled out, there's been a lot of focus on physical problems, pre-existing conditions. But we haven't heard very much about what the ACA means for treating mental illness. And that's something that's a growing concern as mentally ill people fill Michigan's jails and prisons. What could it mean to these people to be able to obtain treatment? Joining us is Ben Robinson. He's the president and CEO of Rose Hill Center in Holly in Oakland County. They offer residential treatment for adults with mental illness. And he's on the executive board of the Michigan Association of Community Mental Health Boards. Welcome, Ben.
Thank you so much.
Well, Vice President Joe Biden has been quoted as saying this country is on the cusp of what he calls remarkable changes in the treatment of mental illness. And you seem to feel that these are kind of exciting times. Why is that?
Well, it truly is exciting times. And if we think back 50 years ago when President Kennedy introduced the Community Mental Health Act, this is really a promise that has been unfulfilled for a long time. It's been a program of services for people that have been growing over 50 years, but access really has not been complete. And the Affordable Care Act allows us to complete that circle and make sure that access is going to be available for every citizen in the United States to quality mental health services.
Take us back to that 50 years. I guess give us a history lesson, if you will. We hear that term, community mental health. I think most people don't really grasp what it means or know that it began with President Kennedy.
Yeah, it is really remarkable. And before this act was signed in by President Kennedy, there was no organized national system of mental health services available at the community level. And most services were provided in psychiatric hospitals and a few random outpatient clinics. And this was the beginning of the movement of deinstitutionalization, of learning how to treat people with mental illness in the community and to bring the resources they need to the community. And it's been often criticized. It's been in many ways underfunded over the years. Access has been imperfect, but getting better. And the Affordable Care Act and the related mental health parity legislation will really complete the circle on this 50-year journey.
So take us into what you're looking forward to now that the Affordable Care Act is here. And what was the accompanying legislation you referred to?
Yeah, just to back the bus up, a couple of years, the mental health parity laws were passed several years before the Affordable Care Act, basically requiring that most insurance plans provide services for people with mental illness at an equal level and rate as other physical health. And this has been a process that's been ongoing of implementation. Only 2 weeks ago, Secretary Sebelius presented to the Congress her plan as to how this really should roll out and what it really should mean in insurance plans.
And it's been a few years since it was passed.
About 4 years. Now, this was also built into the Affordable Care Act, so all of the different benefit plans and structures that have been required of insurance providers in Affordable Care Act have to be provided at parity. But what that means is another story, and that's the piece that's being rolled out right now. So, for example, if there's a benefit for nursing home care in an insurance plan, then in theory there should be a similar benefit for longer-term residential psychiatric care, which there generally isn't. And if there is a benefit for outpatient visits to your doctor, there should be a benefit for equal outpatient visits to your psychiatrist. And the copays and deductibles and limitations should all be the same. So this is really going a long way, combined with the Affordable Care Act, to make sure that quality mental health services will be available to every American, no matter what insurance product they have.
So it's bringing all the insurers along onto the same field, not having disparities, shall we say, between insurance providers?
Yes, but it's going to take a number of years for implementation. There will be court cases and challenges, and ultimately the federal courts will probably determine what this benefit should look like in the long run, because there's so much debate and disagreement on it. If we think about the Americans with Disability Act, which was implemented over 20 years ago, it's taken that 20 years for the courts to really determine what Congress meant and what this act is all about. And so I think we have the same kind of process underway here with mental health parity. Hopefully it won't take that long.
I'm speaking with Ben Robinson, who's the president and the CEO of Rose Hill Center in Holly in Oakland County. They offer residential treatment for adults with mental illness as we explore what the Affordable Care Act could mean for the treatment of the mentally ill in our country and certainly in our state. And we've talked about it here on Stateside. Judge Milton Mack has been here sitting right where you are talking about how we need to look at the mentally ill people who wind up in courts, because that's the police really don't know what to do with them or don't have the training. It makes me wonder what has happened in the time that you've been in mental health care. Has society turned around, or are we still mired in a lot of bad impressions and wrong impressions about the mentally ill?
Well, there's no doubt that stigma has continued to be a big challenge, and one of the reasons that a lot of individuals don't pursue treatment is that embarrassment and fear of social criticism. But the flip side to that is that we have a much more public dialogue about mental health issues. There's much more acceptance of talking about this, of seeking help and looking for help. And the real tragedy is when people are looking for help and they can't access it. And that's where we have to make sure that that loop gets closed. On the correctional side, we really shouldn't be there may be incidents where corrections and law enforcement aren't perfect, but for the most part, they're dealing with tough, tough situations.
Yes, yes.
And don't always have all the tools that they need. State of Michigan is in the process of implementing new mental health courts across the state. Mm-hmm. This has been on a demonstration project in certain counties. It's going to go statewide ultimately, and that will allow judges to offer alternatives to individuals who have been charged with a crime, allowing them to pursue treatment as opposed to incarceration or other types of criminal penalties. So the state of Michigan is very enlightened on all of that. But as it relates to the Affordable Care Act, two elements that are really exciting in Michigan. One is the Medicaid expansion based on income rather mm-hmm. than disability. So we will have about 450 to 500,000 Michiganians who will become eligible based on low income for Medicaid benefits. Those individuals will then become eligible for community mental health services because Michigan's Medicaid program for mental health services is provided through the community mental health system. And that will close the loop on a lot of people who don't have any benefit at all and are relatively low income. So that's a great step forward.
Mm-hmm.
The healthcare exchanges and the benefits in the healthcare exchanges likewise will have mental health services at parity with other physical health services. So anyone who signs up for a program on the healthcare exchange will have access to at least inpatient mental health services and outpatient mental health services, hopefully a broader array once all of this gets sorted out by the regulators and courts. So there will be a good access to individuals. Of course, we are concerned that those that pick the lower level plans,
mm-hmm. the bronze plans
and even the silver plans may be a little disappointed in the amount they're going to have to pay out of pocket. So we encourage people when they sign up for these benefits to take a hard look at not only what the benefit costs to buy per month, but what their potential costs would be and pick the one that's right for them.
So really, Ben, what do you think the potential is of the ACA for changing the lives of people who are battling mental illness?
It's tremendous as long as we can connect people with services and as long as services are available in the community. And that's the piece that has to be built out now. Providers will have to come to the fore with the various insurance providers and become part of their panels so that individuals that are in a managed care health plan would be able to connect with quality mental health providers. Beyond that, we have to then encourage people with serious mental illness to pursue services. And the thing that breaks our hearts the most is seeing families who do have good insurance and do have resources and have loved ones, adults, who have serious mental issues and where the individual with the issue refuses treatment, won't go for help.
Not compliant with meds.
Non-compliant, and that's really what breaks your heart. And that's the real challenge, and often those people do present at the doorstep mm-hmm. of corrections. And getting them diverted from corrections into treatment may be a really, really good opportunity.
It sounds like there's a lot of promise and you have your fingers crossed. I think I hear your fingers crossed that the promise of what's in the ACA will actually be realized in each community.
More than
Michigan.
Fingers crossed. I am absolutely certain that we will have much, much greater access. And our challenge is going to be linking people in need with providers and making sure people get the right service at the right time.
Ben Robinson is the president and the CEO of the Rose Hill Center in Holly and Oakland County. Thank you so much for coming in and talking with us, Ben.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
And be sure to tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock for a special State of Opportunity call-in show with host Jennifer White. Do at-risk kids have more on the line when it comes to testing? We'll explore that question. And you can get lots more information online at michiganradio.org. Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisgetter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.